on a very gut level and a heart level that we can all understand, there's a tremendous stigma and there's a tremendous hatred and hypocrisy towards people in the sex trade. On a more complicated level, it's tied in very much to the laws that exist. It's tied into the laws around poverty. It's tied into laws around colonialism. Sex work laws historically have been used more than anything to control women, mostly working class women, who escaped from sort of patriarchal norms of what a good woman was.
Feminists, abolitionists call for the decriminalization of the industry all the time. What are they saying? They're saying that all women are exploited. They're looking at women who are working, saying, you have not chosen to work. You are exploited. They're on a crusade to save women, but they're in that, they're totally implementing a patriarchal structure of how they're going to do it, and it's ridiculous and absolutely ironic, and they don't realize
that we can play a role in transforming the conditions, that we have a part to play, just like marriage was transformed, just like civic rights were transformed for women, well, so sex work can be transformed as well, and that we can remain sex workers and denounce violence.
That violence, we can choose that we will not have it anymore, that we will eliminate it, because we will eliminate criminalization, we will eliminate the attitudes and the hatred, we will take this violence seriously.
So we are fighting right now to define sexual services as work.
Nice to block the doorway. It is nice to go to jail. There are nicer ways to do it, but the nice ways always fail. It isn't nice, it isn't nice. You told us once, you told us twice, but if that is freedom's price, we don't mind.
Welcome to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy, a special documentary presentation of CKUT's long-term memory radio project. Today we are wrapping up this four-week series by talking about the immense amount of activism and organizing that's going on, locally and internationally, within sex worker communities and the groups they have allied with. We will be talking about the key issues of concern to those organizing and how they connect with other issues of social, political, and economic justice. We will be speaking to Karina Bravo, former president of Ecuador's world-famous sex worker association, the 22nd of June, and also Ana Luis Crego from the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers here in Montreal.
But if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. How about those years of lynching and the shot in Ever's back? Did you say it wasn't proper? Did you stand out on the track? You were quiet just like mice. Now you say we aren't nice. Well, if that is freedom's price, we don't mind. It is nice to block the door.
Bueno, mi nombre es Karina Bravo, pero mi verdadero nombre es Rosa Bravo. Pero tú sabes que en el trabajo sexual hay que adoptar otro nombre y adopté por Karina.
Okay.
Tengo como 9 años haciendo el trabajo sexual.
Okay. Her name is Karina Bravo, and she's been working in sex trade for about 9 years in Ecuador.
Ya. Aparte de haber sido trabajadora sexual, cuando llegué a Machala me gustó mucho la organización y decidí participar dentro de la organización como líder.
Okay, when she got to Machala, she really liked the organization that was working there, and she decided to participate in it, and she took on a leadership role with the organization.
Okay, la Asociación de Trabajadoras Autónomas y Trabajadoras Sexuales se llama 22 de Junio. Esta organización se fundó en el año de 1982 con la idea de 12 mujeres, el quererse organizarse, sí, 12 mujeres con la idea de organizarse debido a la gran discriminación de nuestros derechos humanos, la violencia que veníamos sufriendo en ese entonces.
Okay. The organization is called the 22nd of June, and it's an organization of about, started with 12 women, and they started on the principle that they wanted to fight against the discrimination and the violence that sex workers face in Ecuador.
En 1985, la organización adquiere vida jurídica. En 1987 la organización adquiere vida jurídica.
Vida jurídica,
o sea, está reconocida legalmente la organización.
87. In 1987 the organization got legal status.
Bueno, acá comenzó todo con la idea de las propias compañeras y con apoyo de otras personas también que están afuera y comenzaron a apoyar la idea de las compañeras, así que se comenzaron a organizar. Pero era cuando nos comenzamos a conversar, mira, esto nos está pasando, la policía, los dueños, los maridos, todo el mundo quiere abusar de nosotros, entonces hay que poner un alto. Y así fue que nos fuimos organizando las compañeras. No estuve yo en ese proceso, pero me he sentado mucho a conversar con ella y me da mucho entusiasmo cómo eso ha ido avanzando. Ajá. Y es más que eso, ha avanzado tanto que nosotros también estamos participando, te dije antes, con otras organizaciones de mujeres que no tienen que ver nada con trabajadoras del sector, pero es un gran apoyo a nosotras porque también están luchando por nuestros derechos.
Okay. She's saying that it started off as an organization of it was just discussion amongst a lot of sex workers, and they started off talking about discrimination that they faced and problems with the police and what have you. So they started organizing amongst themselves. And they also got a lot of support from other organizations of women in Ecuador that don't necessarily work with sex workers, but were willing to support a cause. And that's how it started.
Y algo que fue muy importante es que la segunda presidenta que tuvimos fue la persona que dio la cara a los medios de comunicación y dijimos, hey, aquí estamos, somos nosotras, estamos reclamando nuestros derechos. Y eso fue un paso muy importante.
Como ella, super linda.
Ella dio su cara, ahí no nos escondemos, ahí vamos y hablamos y decimos, esto nos está pasando, esto sucede y denunciamos cada vez que hay algo.
En la vida pública.
Sí.
And she was saying that the second president of the organization began to show her face publicly to people and began to speak publicly, and the cause became more public and wider known.
No, en Machala, fue la primera organización a nivel nacional, y a partir de esa organización ahí en Machala fue que comenzaron a organizarse muchas otras organizaciones. Pero cuando recién comenzó en Machala, vinieron muchas compañeras de otra provincia a querer ir a esta provincia, y tuvimos que hacer un alto ahí un ratito porque no hay cama para tanta gente acá.
Okay, so the organization actually started in Machala, Ecuador, and that is actually the first national organization like of sex workers. But it became so big that there were a lot of sex workers who were immigrating to Machala to work with them. And she said at a certain point they had to slow down because they didn't have enough room for people in the center where they work to house all the women that were coming to support them and work with them.
No sé, eso es también, nosotros hemos trabajado la cuestión de los derechos y la sensibilización con las compañeras, especialmente dentro del programa donde yo soy la coordinadora. Trabajamos en el programa La Sala de FEDAES, que es una ONG no gubernamental. Ahí trabajamos con las compañeras todo lo que tiene que ver con nuestros derechos, la participación, lo que tenemos que decir, lo que tenemos que hacer, y por qué la importancia de la organización y que tenemos que estar unidas para lograr cosas en común.
Okay, she says that in her center where she works, La Sala, for example, the big premise is to focus on collective rights and the things that they go through collectively and all the things that they can sort of unite under a common cause.
Bueno, como tú mismo estás diciendo, los machistas también tienen ideas y prejuicios que piensan que nosotros, el hecho de ser trabajadoras sexuales, se olvidan que también somos mujeres y que nos interesa participar en la política. Por ejemplo, yo quiero este año estudiar Derecho y prepararme para también participar en la política, porque también es un punto estratégico que nosotros estamos queriendo cubrir, donde también podemos luchar por nuestros derechos, y ahí ya tenemos que ir caminando las compañeras, y por eso dentro del programa también la vamos a ir preparando en muchas cosas para afrontar a las compañeras a llegar a ese reto, a ese camino, e ir ocupando estancias donde de allá podemos decir, bueno, que vengo a reclamar como mujer y como trabajadora también.
Just gonna add that the thing to know about the association too, and it just from conversations and things I've learned, are that in a few things. The first is that in Ecuador, they were the first women to organize after the fall of the dictatorship. They were formed before the first women's organizations, so they have had unequivocal support from the feminist movement because they were some of the first women to fight for self-determination and workers' rights. So they have a very specific partnership with human rights groups and feminist groups, and sex workers are an integral part of the feminist movement. They've also been really strong in denouncing FTA, La Luta, and also they've two two of the sex workers from the association ran for city council last year.
What she was saying was that a lot of times people seem to forget that sex workers are women too, and mm-hmm. they're women that are interested in politics and have the rights abused as other women do. And she says, especially with her organization, they've really tried to foster an environment which focuses on bringing out rights and talking about discrimination. And she was saying, for example, she wants to be studying law in the future too, and her organization has been sort of a good place to foster those kind of interests because it's all focused on rights. And
nosotros hemos hecho dos paros. El primer paro que se hizo fue en el periodo de una compañera que ahora de nuevo es presidenta de la organización, Mariana Guevara, que fue en el año de 1988. Fue el primer paro, pero eso fue por congelación de arriendos, porque allá nos cobran por semana el valor del arriendo. Y también para que se respete el trato, ¿no? Fue por 3 días en el cual se cerraron todos los lugares de trabajo. Solo en una provincia estábamos encerrada dentro del prostíbulo, pero las demás compañeras como apoyo vinieron y se encerraron también. Y de otras provincias decían que iban a venir las compañeras a apoyarnos. Ese fue el primer paro en el cual ganamos, se congeló el arriendo y se ganó todas las propuestas. Y nos encerramos, fue algo muy divino porque dentro de epidemiología encerramos al dueño y no lo dejamos salir. Ay. Había medios de comunicación, nadie salía de ahí. Ay. Todo el mundo estaba asustado.
¿Y qué ganamos, por ejemplo, el congelador?
Algo que la congelación de los precios, ¿no? Por ejemplo, ese precio durante 3-4 años, sí. ¿No? El mismo precio y no sube.
Te entiendo. Okay, she's talking about the first big strike that the association did was in the motels where the women were working. Mm-hmm. They were fighting for price freezes because the owner of the hotel was trying to raise the prices for the sex workers that were working there. And what they actually did during the first strike was the owner of the hotel was, they stayed, and it was a lockdown in the hotels, and they weren't working at all. And the owner was brought in with them. They didn't let the owner leave. They took him hostage as well. Yeah. And she said that they actually gained a lot of support with other women that were coming outside of Machala to support them as well. And in the end, they did get the prices frozen.
En el 2000 fue el segundo paro donde yo ya era líder ahí y okay. Fue que nos tomamos el mismo lugar porque ese mismo lugar como es muy concurrido donde están la mayor cantidad de mujeres que trabajan, 200 mujeres, sí. Igual los dueños siempre que van a alzar el precio, entonces entre todas hicimos como un complot de que nos íbamos a tomar el prostíbulo, nos íbamos a encerrar, pero nos preparamos ya llevando todo lo que íbamos a necesitar, ajá, sin importarnos los días que iban a estar ahí. Esta vez no solamente estábamos peleando por la cuestión del precio, sino que por las condiciones, mejorar las condiciones, ajá, de trabajo, y igual que se respeten nuestros derechos. Y lo hicimos un día en el cual iba a haber la consulta popular, que iban a estar todos los medios de comunicación para que justo ese día todo el mundo venga. Sí, todo el mundo venga.
¿Había prensa?
Sí, okay. Vinieron de todos los lugares a ver qué es lo que estaba pasando. Ay. Y era un día muy importante porque era el de preguntar al pueblo si queríamos ser autónomos. Ay. Nosotros hicimos ese lío ese día. Muchas autoridades que nunca habían ido a conocer el lugar vengan y palpen cómo estaba la situación ahí, cómo estábamos nosotros trabajando, la higiene y todo lo demás.
Ay, como los periodistas y todo eso. Okay. In 2000, there was a second strike in which she was actually the leader of this particular strike. And she said this time they weren't just fighting for to freeze the prices of the hotels. They were also fighting for better working conditions for the women because they weren't washing sheets and weren't cleaning the facilities properly. And this time they said there was a lot of support of women that came from outside of Machala to support them. But they also had a lot of press support this time. There are a lot of journalists and that came to see what the situation was about, so they got a lot of public support for that strike, and that was in 2000.
One of the really cool things that they do is that, much like in Nevada, where the brothel tax pays for the entire 911 ambulance service of rural Nevada, in Ecuador, the sex workers sell condoms. They have a condom bank. They sell condoms to the clients, and all the money goes into a fund that the association runs. And the money in the fund goes if a sex worker is injured, if a sex worker is sick, or if a sex worker dies, then it buys her the funeral stuff, and if a sex worker wants to retire. But what started to happen, and that's part of this, what she was mentioning before, what started to happen is that a lot of the people from the neighborhood who didn't have money for medication started to come to the sex worker center. So the sex workers ended up being, right now, the services that they provide at the center, for example, of accompaniment for HIV-positive people, the majority of HIV-positive people who come aren't sex workers. Oftentimes it's homemakers or it's men. But all of the support is run for HIV-positive people is run out of the sex worker centers.
Que lo que le puedo decir como mujer que hago trabajo sexual, que nunca se debe por vencida, que siga adelante con sus ideales y lo que piensa, que eso es muy importante. Y el de tratar de buscar otras compañeras, que también hay muchas que tienen los mismos ideales, e irse uniendo y crear una fuerza.
She says that it's really important to find, first of all, people that share the same values as you or share the same problems as you and unite with them, and that'll give you a lot of power. That'll be like a source of empowerment.
Ay, bueno, lo que yo anhelo algún día que se dé una ley, pero que nos beneficie a todas las mujeres, no solamente a mí que estoy en el Ecuador, sino algo que sea totalmente. Por eso yo le estaba proponiendo a Ana Luis que escribamos en la lista y digamos hacer una red, pero una red mucho más abierta, no una red latina, sino internacional, donde todas podamos ir y decir, bueno, esto está pasando en mi país y esto yo quiero.
She's saying she hopes that they can maybe start forming a network, an alliance of women internationally, not just in Ecuador, but around the world, and talk about the experiences, the common experiences that they share.
Que algún día seamos totalmente autónomas, dueñas de nuestro trabajo y de lo que hacemos y tener un negocio en cada lugar de nosotros.
She says, and also
de
she,
la organización o de nosotras.
She says that it's also very important
que no haya más explotadores.
She says that one day she hopes that they are completely in control of their own work, completely in control, and they can self-support themselves and won't have to face any violence or discrimination.
That was Karina Bravo, former president of Ecuador's world-famous sex workers association, the 22nd of June. She was here in Montreal for the Festival for the Rights of Sex Workers, speaking about the actions she has been involved in Ecuador. Her translator during this interview is Adriana Greenblatt.
The Associated Press, April 15, 2003. Stockholm, Sweden, AP World News. Rosina Sambo paid her taxes promptly this month. Then she filed a police complaint against the Swedish government for accepting the money because she earned it from prostitution. In Sweden, a Scandinavian country of 8.9 million residents, it's illegal to obtain sexual services from someone for money. But it's not illegal to sell those services. The law adopted in 1999 targets not prostitutes, but the buyers. People arrested for trying to pay for sex face up to 6 months in jail, plus fines that are linked to the amount of their annual income. According to Sambo, the government legitimized her profession and nullified its own law by accepting her tax payment of 5,000 kroner, equal to an amount of US$589, on April 11th. Getting the right to pay tax means that the Swedish government has confirmed that prostitution is a profession, she asserted. Sambo, a prostitute since 1984, moved to Sweden in 1986 from Portugal. A native of Angola and a Portuguese citizen, she was given her notice of tax assessment for self-employment workers from the tax authority in Varberg, 480 kilometers southwest of the capital, Stockholm. She said that she wanted to pay her taxes so she'd have the same access as other workers, self-employed or not, to a pension and state-paid sick leave. But by accepting her money, the government must legalize prostitution, she claims. I am a sex worker, and I demand that the law criminalizing the buying of sex be abolished, that the government respects our rights as sex workers, she said. Sambo said she's prepared to sue the government and the European Court in Strasbourg to have the prostitution law overturned.
If you are just tuning in, this is Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy, a special 4-week series here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Up next is a conversation with Ana Luisa Crego, a member of the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers and an active organizer within a number of other social struggles. Ana Luisa and I speak in depth about the relationship anti-prostitution policy and lobbying has with anti-migration efforts, efforts to control women's sexuality historically, and racist attitudes in the West, which have long shaped and directed national policy agendas.
My name is Ana Luisa Crego. I'm a sex worker activist, and in Montreal, I was one of the founding members of the Coalition for the Rights of Sex Workers, La Coalition pour les droits des travailleuses et travailleurs du sexe, back in 1996. One of the things that we've been working on was the Sex Workers' Rights Festival back in February. Aside from that, there's always like two or three pots on the stove at once, so one of the really cool constructive things going on right now is people are trying to envision what a perfect law would be, what we would want, how we would define labor standards and labor rights within sex work. So that's one of the projects that's going on. I'm also in contact with different networks of sex work groups all across Latin America and also across Europe and Asia. So I'm one of the people in the coalition who sort of keeps the pulse of what's going on elsewhere.
Would you say, I mean, I sort of use the phrase sex worker rights movement. Do you think that's accurate to call it a movement?
I think there are many different movements. I definitely think there's a movement in the sense, or many movements coming together in that there is, and maybe this is what's most exciting for us, is there is more and more a big push to work with groups in other countries and to work together. And I think that that push is being felt now more than ever with the incredible panic around so-called trafficking in women, because what it essentially has resulted in is an intense crackdown on sex workers domestically in the, quote, first world, on the part of an incredible alliance between certain mainstream feminist groups and the Christian right in the United States. So in the United States, you're talking about an anti-trafficking program that was put forth by the Southern Baptist Convention, with the National Organization of Women, with the Feminist Majority Foundation, with Feminists for Life, with a very strong anti-labor bend, a very strong, quote, law and order push, which is like very classic right wing, a very strong anti-prostitution message, and a very strong anti-migration agenda. You're also seeing the same thing happen in Europe. So in France, the latest anti-prostitution law that just recriminalized prostitution was put together by French feminists with the Catholic right and with the anti-migration lobby. Mm-hmm. So what's happening is that the anti-prostitution agenda has been taken on by this, like, coalition of convenience, and the effects being felt are most directly being felt by migrant women in general and prostitutes in general. So what this has meant for sex worker groups in the, quote, third world and second world is that they're also coming under attack. They're being massively defunded under the same pretext of, quote, trafficking in women. So there was recently a big open letter call for help that was written by the Alliance of Sex Worker Groups in Asia, and which includes sex worker groups in Thailand, Cambodia, Bangladesh, India, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and a bunch of other places. And what the letter said was that increasingly under pressure from first world feminist groups and their Christian cohorts, intense pressure was being put to completely defund any of their organizations, either HIV prevention work or labor activism or human rights activism, under the so-called, you know, the pretense of fighting trafficking in women. And so what that has meant is that it's meant that sex worker groups in the third, second, and first world have had to band together and try and fight this as a whole. And the interesting thing, the problem, is that for a lot of sex workers here is that it took us long enough to try and find the vocabulary or the way to articulate our own agenda and our own rights. And what's happening now more and more is that you have sex workers who will say, I'm fighting for my rights. And I've had this happen to me just like 3 days ago. And you'll have somebody from I don't know, a mainstream feminist group, and most of us consider ourselves feminists too, right, but come up and say, well, by fighting for your rights, you're oppressing 12-year-olds in Thailand, which I find mind-boggling, because you would never tell somebody doing union activism here that they were contributing to sweatshops in Thailand, especially not when they're working in direct collaboration with Thai workers. But they're getting away with it here. And they're getting away with it here because people... It's so intricate to take apart all of the bullshit agenda behind so-called trafficking. And people do feel bad. Like, we've been fighting human rights abuses. That's what we're about. So if people start to accuse you of colluding in them, it's really hard to be like, no, you're full of shit, right? And so it's been incredibly useful to paralyze sex worker groups here, as well as to completely hammer down on sex worker groups in the second and third world. And then the upshot being that now we're working together more and more.
Organized sex workers in the third world have denounced sensationalized and self-righteous discourse and policy by Westerners addressing the so-called trafficking of third world women between borders. The efforts of anti-immigrationists, feminists, and NGOs alike have contributed to the popular characterization of sex work migration not as an issue of self-directed economic betterment, but as the forced trafficking of women in need of rescue and return. I asked Ana Luise to talk about the discourse here in the West regarding trafficking and its relationship with the anti-immigration agenda.
It's a very old one, is the first thing you have to know, and it's a very conservative one. The talk around trafficking in women is really difficult to talk about because it's... I do not use the word trafficking in women anymore unless I'm using it in quotations, because I think it's lost all meaning. So trafficking is often used in a labor context to talk about forcing someone across a border or smuggling someone illegally across a border and then forcing them into coercive or unfair labor conditions. And if you look at it that way, then trafficking exists primarily in, like, agriculture and domestic work and construction work. But the interest of talking about it in terms of prostitution is to create this, like, highly sensational thing that I think, first of all, serves to take attention away from the more common and often state-sponsored forms of labor abuse of migrants. It also does very little to help migrant sex workers to have better working conditions, because it's essentially more repression, and so in the long run it just kind of screws you over more. The anti-trafficking stuff, just like as a historical capsule, like, usually is attached to very specific historical periods. So the first time it came up in North America was in the late 1800s, when a lot of women, Asian women, were migrating to the West Coast in the United States and Canada. And so the United States passed a law against the trafficking of Asian women. And what it did was it allowed border guards to sort of become barometers of women's morality. So if an Asian woman came across who wasn't married and presumably wasn't Christian for the most part, then they could just assume that she was a whore or she was a prostitute. And if you want to look at exactly what impact that had on women's migration, in the 10 years after the law was passed prohibiting the migration of the trafficking of Chinese women or the immigration of Asian prostitutes as a whole, the immigration of Chinese women in the next 10 years went down 69%. That is, the legal immigration did. So it's an anti-immigration agenda. It's a moral agenda. It came up again in that turn of the century around what they called the so-called white slave trade. And it came up at that point at a time where there was this incredible anxiety around women's growing autonomy, women's migrating, industrialization. And it was a way to control, in the States, the laws that were passed at that time were to control working class single women from arriving in the States. They were used to repress prostitutes who were working in the States. They were used to control the migration of interracial couples. So a white woman and a black man migrating across state borders, well, of course, according to the logic of the time of, like, you know, white supremacists of the time, why would a white woman be with a black man? Of course she must be forced, and of course he must be her pimp, and if they're crossing state lines, then of course he's trafficking her. So it was used to persecute black men. So what you're seeing now is this, it's a very, very similar. At the time also, it was part of a general purity crusade, like it was attached to a crusade to raise the age of consent for sex. And a lot of the feminists now see themselves as having inherited that mission. So a lot of the groups are also lobbying for a raise of the age of consent law. It's a very, very fearful of sexuality, very fearful of migration agenda. If you read the big, nastiest of them all are the Coalition Against Trafficking in Women. If you read there, one of the texts I was reading by this woman named Janice Raymond, she says, 300 to 400 Bangladeshi women migrate illegally to India every day. So what's really terrifying her is illegal migration of women, not labor exploitation, not coercion.
I think it's really interesting that all of these seemingly disparate units would form coalitions, you know, the feminists and the Christian right and anti-immigrationists, etc., against prostitution and the trafficking of prostitution. Are these sort of coalitions and the links that are being formed between them, are they being paralleled within the activist community? Like, are links being made between pro-migration migration activists and pro-immigration activists and sex worker rights organizers?
They are, and they are in different places. So, for example, in France, when they were, the law that was passed against prostitution was part of a broader law that was against migration, and that was an incredibly repressive law against people who were sans papier or without papers. It was a law that also called for an intense policing and cracking down and prison industrial solution, quote unquote, for crime in the HLMs, which are the equivalent of the inner city in North America. And so there were coalitions formed around that. There have been coalitions formed all over Europe between migrant workers groups and sex workers groups. A lot of the time, because sex workers, for example, in Austria, identify as migrant workers, not just as sex workers. To them, they're sex workers, but the sex workers, the group of migrant sex workers in Austria, call themselves the migrant worker women of Austria, because to them there's nothing special about the fact that the work they do is sex work, especially since a lot of them also do other work. So some of them will also do domestic work, or their husbands are also migrant workers who do other kinds of work, and so are their children and their cousins and their, so they identify as migrant workers and see the anti-trafficking initiatives as essentially anti-migrant initiatives more than anything else. So those have been, kind of alliances have been formed. In Latin America, I know that a lot of the sex worker groups have a phenomenally positive relationship with feminist groups and are often the leaders of the feminist movement in different countries, as well as being completely supported and are absolutely boggled that the feminist institutions in North America and Europe are anti-prostitution and don't consider it work. To them, it is sort of a mind-blowing thing. They don't really... They're just like, what the heck went wrong? They also have very strong relationships with labor. In Argentina, for example, they're part of the major labor organization. In Mexico, they're part of the major labor organization. There have been a lot of alliances in South Asia with different queer groups and different queer rights groups and different people who've been part of movements around HIV and AIDS. The difference is the money. That we don't have the money. And the anti-trafficking stuff represents billions and billions of dollars of money that don't just go to right-wing groups, but that go to projects like militarizing the borders and under the pretense of anti-trafficking. So a whole bunch of money was poured into helping to militarize the Polish-German border. And it's great. It's a great PR coup because they've done it. For example, in the U.S., there was, I think it was around 97, 98, Amnesty International came out with a report that showed that a whole number of Mexican migrants had been tortured by U.S. border guards. And that happened to be the same time, under the pretense of anti-trafficking, they poured a whole bunch of money into border guards and border systems. And so they beefed up the border under the pretense of saving poor women who were being trafficked by nefarious migrant men of color, right? Because it's like it's this same stereotype of the praying pimp from the third world, right? And so here, all of a sudden, you had these white border guards who were, like, saving the poor women from their families and their men, or the feminist groups, even, they're like, very often the pimps are, quote, immigrant husbands. Like, they really have no problem with working with those kinds of, like, major stereotypes. And so it was great, because it was a real coup, it was a real way to pour in this money and pretend that the border guards and the cops were going to really be there to protect women or sex workers for the first time ever. So that's the difference. I mean, the alliances we're making are important and forceful, but theirs have so much to do with power and money. Status of Women Canada, for example, one of their major areas of funding is trafficking in women. You have a horrific situation in terms of the abuse of labor rights of domestic workers in this country. You have a travesty in terms of the labor rights of many sex workers in this country. But no, we're plugging all our funding into working trafficking in women, and within a very specific framework, right? So that means that a lot of the groups who could be our allies, who work a lot with migrant women workers, are often selling out their agenda to this anti-trafficking agenda because that's where the money is. It also means that people, and I don't know if it's a guilt of being in the first world or being fearful of colluding again with like the people who are abusive in different sex work contexts, are afraid to challenge what trafficking in women means, are afraid to challenge some of the discourses that are anti-prostitution, that claim that all prostitution is degrading and harmful. They're very afraid to challenge it. And what's really unfortunate about that is that because they don't challenge it, they leave us alone to defend our backs. And when we here do not challenge the myth that all sex work in the third world is forced, then what I have been told by sex workers from third world groups who called me on the carpet and were like, you have sold us down the river because of your own guilt from being from the first world, is that you're letting them essentially take the same anti-prostitution stereotypes and use them to attack them. So I think what's hard is that we do have some allies, but the money talks, and for a lot of activist groups, or not activist groups so much as community groups, that's what's setting a lot of the agenda.
I asked Anna Louise in her own words to outline what she thinks the key issues are within sex worker activism.
In Montreal, much as in Europe, because there's been this big, big anti-prostitution wave in Europe, which is essentially very much tied up with the big, big anti-migration, like the humongous racist tide sweeping over Europe. It's translated here into very similar politics in Quebec. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of the anti-prostitution tracts that are published in France are republished in our newspapers. What that has meant is that over the past few years here, as well as from what I understand, most sex worker groups in Asia have dealt with a very similar thing. And it's just starting to be felt in some places in Latin America, is we've been on the defensive because we've been losing ground. We'd been gaining ground and gaining it and gaining it, and we started to lose it. In places like the States, the people who have the most to lose are migrant people in general. I mean, prostitutes have a lot to lose, but prostitutes are so badly off in the States and have so few rights and are so completely criminalized, it's hard to see how much more they can take away from them, right? Whereas in France, when they were in a situation where they had a certain amount of tolerated prostitution, to be recriminalized is an absolute travesty. So from what I can tell, there's a real big, in Europe and in most sex worker groups in Asia right now, the big thing is fighting off this incredible wave of anti-prostitution initiatives. One of the interesting things that happened was that, just like to give you perspective, is that in the 80s, with HIV/AIDS activism, a lot of sex worker groups popped up in different places. And the funding that went to HIV/AIDS activist groups directed at prostitutes was the first time, even though oftentimes it came with a problematic idea of protecting the rest of the population from prostitutes, or the stigma of assuming that prostitutes were at higher risk for HIV than anyone else. The interesting thing was, it was the first time funding went to either prostitutes themselves or to groups that weren't trying to necessarily save prostitutes from sex work with a moral agenda. And out of that came a whole bunch of really cool human rights groups, like the Sonogachi Project in Calcutta, that now has 60,000 sex workers as part of it. It started out as an HIV/AIDS prevention project, and it became a sex worker-led human rights and labor rights project. And they fought very strongly against forced social reinsertion and rehabilitation, or these so-called rescue raids done by Christian right groups in the States, like International Justice Mission. So those really positive groups came out. And not only that, but they managed to protect not just sex workers, but their clients from HIV. So the rate of HIV transmission is extremely low in places that have had these really amazing social movements. And now what's happened is they're being completely defunded. by a right-wing agenda that is supported by most feminist groups in the first world. So that has meant that has been a major field of activism in certain places. I think it's very different depending on context. I don't know what sex workers groups in Africa have been organizing around. I know that one of the major priorities for sex worker groups in Latin America and some places in Africa has been getting free quality condoms and not having condoms be used as proof of prostitution. In some places where the struggle is farther along, the priorities are different. So in Ecuador, where they've been active for 20 years and have a super, super strong sex workers movement that's amazing, that's totally backed by the feminist movement, their major priority now is building these collectively run brothels with state money and getting the constitution to officially recognize the rights of sex workers against discrimination and having sex workers be officially recognized in the labor code.
What about just locally, the coalition, for example, what does it consider its priorities to be?
The first is decriminalization. And I think that's a very big priority for almost every group that I know of. People have very different ways of looking at decriminalization, different strategies for how to deal with it, but it seems to be a pretty universal thing. And the second is labor rights and human rights, which are sort of inextricable. So, and then the third is, like, which is linked to all of this, is to get over all of the stigma, the myth, and the outright hatred of sex workers, because whether it's different gentrification projects or whether it's supposedly well-meaning yet extremely controlling law projects like the ones you talked about on the other shows, the sort of stereotypes around sex workers permeate kind of all levels.
Most countries in the world, including Canada, oscillate between systems of either criminalization or legalization of the sex trade. Most sex worker advocates, however, fight for the decriminalization of the industry. Decriminalization can be envisioned in a number of ways, but means literally taking sex work out of the criminal code. It also presumes that any of the forms of abuse that can occur within the sex trade are already covered within existing laws, such as labor laws dealing with youth.
The other thing with decriminalization is that it means that if it's recognized as labor, if somebody in another country wants to migrate to work in erotic labor, then they can apply for a license to come work in erotic labor, and they don't have to depend on middlemen or situations that can be sketchy where they can lose power and control over their own migration and their own work. And end up in situations that can be exploitative or abusive. So, for example, in Holland that just decriminalized, a number of, I believe it was Polish sex workers, sued the Dutch government to be able to have legally enter on a worker's visa to work as prostitutes because they were Polish prostitutes, they wanted to make more money in the Netherlands, and they wanted to do so legally without depending on a middleman. Mm-hmm. So it offers that as a possibility. The downside is that, like any other labor, you're still going to have none of these solutions, these three systems, ever resolve what happened to people who are illegal workers until you deal with the fact that some people are made illegal by, migrants are made illegal by the system. Migrants still do not have the rights, the same rights as other workers. They're often under the table. So that's one of the problems. The other thing with decriminalization to watch out for, which is similar to all of these situations, is that you want an organized labor force if you're on the left, or if you think in those terms, right? And the difficulty is to make sure that when it becomes decriminalized, you don't have a situation like you have now, or that often exists under legalization, where you have these big, where the people who have the most control are oftentimes big owners, right? You hope that decriminalization will bring more worker control over everyone's environment. But there's always the possibility that under decriminalization, you'll end up like any other industry, that you won't necessarily have better working rights in the sex trade than you would in the telemarketing trade. So, unless you organize.
I wanted to ask you how you thought other systems, how other systems of oppression and other issues tie into the context in which sex workers are fighting. So I wanted to talk about issues of like poverty and racism as it relates to the conditions that sex workers face and how they're trying to fight.
I think the context depend really on the different places and what the different laws are and what they came out of. I think some examples stand out more than others. So in Puerto Rico, during Spanish colonialism, a lot of the anti-prostitution laws were put in right after the abolition of slavery, and the idea was that the anti-prostitution laws allowed for the forceful imprisonment or within a certain area of women who were prostitutes. And of course, so the women who were deigned prostitutes just happened to be the women who had just supposedly been, well, liberated from slavery, so it was just a way of continuing to imprison them. I think that here, one of the clear things to me is that the old anti-trafficking laws not only very definitely had a racist agenda, but they were part of a whole bunch of laws that were eugenics laws. So, for example, the law that prohibits prostitutes from migrating to the United States, which is still on the books, also prohibits the migration, quote, of Chinese coolies, stupid, I think it's like idiots, lunatics, and mentally retarded people. Like, I don't remember what exactly the term they use is, but it's something along those lines. So these were laws that were part of a eugenics, even if it wasn't, if the word eugenics wasn't used yet to describe it, it was part of some an attempt, I believe, to consolidate sort of white colonial power. And the eugenics mentality was that the way you did that was that you eliminated things within the white power structure that made you weak, as well as eliminating all these things that you consider to be less civilized. And so to me, that's how a lot of those laws came about. And I think it's like, it really depends how they're applied and used in different places. In Montreal, prostitution laws are by and large used against women on the street. They're used against transsexuals all the time. They're used to harass and create violence and repress transsexual street prostitutes for no other reason than that they are transsexual street prostitutes. They are used against women who are poor more than they're used against women who can afford their own lawyers, which also makes a big difference in the long run. They're used in the States at least 7 times more against women of color than against white women. But it's also complicated. I mean, Soleil talked about this a lot at the festival, and I thought this was really important, which is that sometimes you don't know when somebody is attacked. If they were attacked because they're a prostitute, because they're transsexual, because they're native, because they're poor, because they use drugs, it could be all 5, it could be all 3. You can't separate those strands in a person, but sometimes it's hard to say.
I wanted to ask you when you thought it was appropriate and relevant to be engaging in the issue of violence, and how violence itself, when it's talked about, needs to be filled out in a more comprehensive way, so that it's not reduced to the stereotypes of violent pimps and violent clients, but an actual discussion can ensue about state violence and police brutality and those sort of things. But also, especially in terms of media, how it can be detrimental to the sex worker rights movement to be constantly harboring on issues of violence.
It's interesting because I was talking to somebody a while back, and we were talking, and we came upon the similarities of how for sex workers it's very difficult because denouncing violence is very important, and yet it's always, or almost always, used against us and used to denounce prostitution as violent and sordid and harmful. And the parallel that the other person drew was that they said, well, it's very interesting because it's a lot like in Native communities when you're denouncing violence, and then the media just uses it to reproduce the stereotype of Native people are violent, and so it's a very tricky situation. And it's a tricky situation because oftentimes in activist circles, that's what you're doing. You're denouncing what's wrong, and that's not a full picture of what life is. So when we're talking about things we need to change in the sex workers' rights movement, we're talking about violence, we're talking about poor labor conditions, we're talking about all these things, and people go away with a perspective on sex work where they think it's just, it reinforces their stereotypes. And not only does it reinforce their stereotypes, it reinforces the idea that if you chose to work in sex work, well, it's your own damn fault if something happens to you, because you should have known it was dangerous and violent and you've got what you had coming. Or it reinforces the only reason that you should possibly work in sex work is if you were forced, because it's violent and harmful and bloody blah 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 blah. And it's extremely detrimental. And it's very difficult to talk about delicately, because the violence is an issue when it exists, but it is not necessarily widespread to everyone. It is not everybody's experience. I don't want to romanticize sex work, but I also don't want to paint it as something bleak, because the thousands of sex workers I know and have a pretty kind of boring la-di-da experience of sex work. Like, it's a lot of waiting on the curb or waiting by the phone, or it really is not, for most people that I have known, and I have known thousands, it's just a little more real. And the difficulty I have as well is that the way the media talks about sex work and some activists talk about sex worker is so entirely voyeuristic that it's really disgusting to me, because there's really, it's an exploitation of the pain and the harm that some people have gone through in a way that's supposed to just rile people up or push their buttons, or I guess supposedly it's supposed to push them to action, but really what it feels like to me is that they're trying to either elicit like pity or disgust is usually what comes across. And it's just, it's really horrific to watch. And it's all the more horrific to watch because the people who do it the most are never there with us when we're actually organizing actions against it. All of the feminists in Quebec who go on and on about sexual slavery are never at any of our demonstrations or events when we're denouncing concrete violence that's happening. They are just appropriating it in order to prove their political point, which ultimately does more harm and creates more of a possibility of violence than anything else, because it's their moral agenda. The other thing is, like, the criminalization itself is a violence, because I feel that we feel that not only police repression and oftentimes the brutality that comes with it is violence, but imprisonment is violence. People assume that sex work is inherently violent. It is not inherently violent, but we have a system that both fosters and encourages violence by making sex work criminalized, because it means people have little if no recourse if they're the victim of anything, whether it's their boyfriend or whether they're, you know, whether it's related to sex work or not.
I wanted to ask you what keeps you hopeful as a sex worker rights activist.
I think if I look at the gains that other groups have made, I think, okay, they managed to go really far. Like in Ecuador, I mean, they fought and fought and fought, and they have won so much respect. I think here, we're farther behind by a long shot, but people use the word sex worker. That's a big thing. That means not just that they use the word, it means they've at some point been exposed to what most presumably some sex workers have had to say at some point. Also, it encourages me that I think my generation of feminists and my generation in general is much, much, much different than the feminist organizations that are working with the Christian right. I think about sexuality as a whole. You know what I mean? I don't think there's the same sexual conservatism. I don't think that they're going to be burning porn in the streets anytime soon. And I think that's really exciting. I think that this wave of feminists is much, much, much more supportive of sex workers' rights and has heard the issues and knows what the issues are much more. So that's really encouraging. I think there's more support from the union movement and workers' movement too. I don't think that there's quite the same collaboration between migrant groups and sex worker groups and migrant sex worker groups here as there is elsewhere, but I think that can come with time. So that makes me hopeful, because I think we have come a long way in that respect. One of the things that makes me hopeful, and it's like I tell a story all the time because it's my like happy story, is that, well, the one is the woman in Sweden who's suing the government. That totally makes me hopeful. The other is they were doing like an information poll on the street for the news, you know, where they go up to people and they're like, what do you think? And it was like, are you for the legalization of prostitution? And they got like these dudes, right, with like their backpacks and their like friendship bracelets, and they were like, no, we're for the decriminalization of prostitution. And I was like, whoa! I mean, it took me years to understand the difference. And here were these random kids on the street who like not only figured it out, but were completely supportive. And I thought, okay, we're on to something. There's inroads we've made that are incalculable now, but that will support us later. So I think that's exciting.
How do you think non-sex workers can act in solidarity with sex workers? And what do you think solidarity is?
I think one thing is to get involved in the different groups. And usually there's a few different groups. Like in Montreal, there's a lot of different ways of getting involved. There's the Coalition, but there's also Stella, but there's also Zero Zero has a prostitution program. There's a whole bunch of different things. I mean, on the one hand, I think for, in terms of people listening at CKUT, a lot of you guys are involved in different community groups. So it's really pushing those groups to take on supportive positions. Because unfortunately, and this is so sad for so many of us who have been such a part of other activist circles, to be fighting against groups that are supposed to be pretty progressive is totally disheartening, especially when we work together on other issues. So I think that's a really big one. I think pushing for decriminalization is a really, really big one. I think challenging the stereotypes around sex work. It doesn't mean I think people should be thought police. It doesn't mean I think people shouldn't be open to talking about it. Like, I think people air it out. Like, if you're like, but I think everyone is getting hurt, or I do think it's wrong. Like, air it out, talk it out, figure it out. I just think that it's about figuring it out and doing the work that needs to be done.
I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes amid rumors of death, calling out to everyone who would listen, it is time to move us all into another century. Time for freedom and racial and sexual justice. Time for women and children and men. Time for hands unbound. I had come into the city wearing peaceful breasts and the spaces between us smile. I had come into the city carrying life in my eyes. And they followed us in their cars with their computers and their tongues crawled with caterpillars. And they bumped us off the road, turned over our cars. And they bombed our buildings, killed our babies. And they slaughtered our doctors, maintaining our bodies. And their courts changed into confessionals. But we kept on organizing, we kept on teaching, believing, loving, doing what was holy, moving to a higher ground, even though our hands were full of slaughtered teeth. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace. But we held out our eyes, delirious with grace.
You have been listening to Heating Up Radio, a look at the sex trade and its advocacy, the final episode of a 4-week series. Thanks to Karina Bravo and Anna Louise Crago. Thanks also to Gretchen King here at CKUT. Thank you as well to everyone who has been involved in the production of this series, especially to my guests who have so well articulated the issues and complexities of sex work and the struggle for sex worker rights. If you would like a copy of this week's episode or the series as a whole, call CKUT's news department here in Montreal at 514-398-6787, extension 2593. My name is Brett Story for CKUT 90.3 FM Long-Term Memory Radio. Thanks for listening.
Come, I say come, you sitting still in domestic bacteria. Come, I say come, you standing still in double-breasted mornings. Come, I say come, and return to the fight, this fight for the earth, this fight for our children, this fight for our life. We need your hurricane voices, we need your sacred hands. I say come, sister, brother, to the battlefield. Come into the rainforest, come into the hood, come into the barrio, come into the schools, come into the abortion clinics, come into the prisons, come and caress our spines. I say come, wrap your feet around justice. I say come, wrap your tongues around truth. I say come, wrap your hands with deeds and prayer. You brown ones, you yellow ones, you black ones, you gay ones, you white ones, you lesbian ones, come, 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 come to this battlefield called life, call life, call life, call life, call life, call life, 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 life.